BBC FM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello, Bristol. Welcome to BBC FM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and apologies if you tuned in the last hour to hear Red and Griff's unmissable extravaganza. They're temporarily on Mondays at the moment, but we'll be back on Fridays soon. So, on to city politics, and this week's Bristol's first black woman councillor, potential black mayor of the city even, Shirley Brown, was bullied out of office by the city's lawyers, judges and political rivals. And the Evening Post. So we ask, in the last 200 years, while politicians talk about racial equality, has anything really changed in Bristol? I'm joined this week by Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Woolacott. An old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, with nowhere near enough paid work to go round, and those jobs there are not paying enough to live on, how long are we going to put up with the war on Britain by the fraudsters still walking around in the streets of London? That is, Britain's financial terrorists and their political poodles in Downing Street. Well, tonight, the censored story of the cuts. One man who spent his life predicting the present financial crisis and spelling out solutions, who's hardly being listened to. He's the convener for decades of the UK Green Party's Economics Working Group and publisher for nearly 20 years of a magazine called Sustainable Economics, Brian Leslie. He'll explain what's gone wrong with our money system and how to fix it in the second hour after six. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 9, wet on Saturday, sunny on Sunday. Rather the opposite, I seem to remember, is what we were saying last week. But anyway, wet on Saturday, sunny on Sunday this weekend. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, warming up quite a bit. Cooler, though, at the beginning of the week. A fairly cloudy week with the wettest days looking like Tuesday and Wednesday. Next weekend, that's the 26th, 27th of February, highs of 11 Celsius, wet on Saturday, sunny on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Woolacott. Hi, Mike, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
Now, you're a Labour councillor. You've just got in. You replaced, I think, a Conservative councillor. But Labour Party has left this country in a terrible mess, hasn't it?
Well, I think the financial sector has left this country in a particular mess. I think Labour merely responded to the environment at a time.
But so who's in charge when Gordon Brown was running the country? Was it the city or was it Gordon Brown?
Well, international capital tends to set the agenda for everybody, doesn't it?
Okay, what about you then, Mike, as a new councillor to the city? What's your day job?
I'm a full-time official with a communication workers union here at the main Royal Mail sorting site up in Felton.
Okay, and what brought you into politics originally?
It was a Conservative government in the 1980s that brought me into politics originally.
And for those that don't remember the Conservative government back then, what was it that sort of politicised you about what Margaret Thatcher was up to?
I think it was the way that she sought to break the strength of the trade union movement within the country. That did a great deal of work to try to equalise some of the social inequality that was going on, and obviously the social inequality that has been created since is evidence that that was a very negative thing to do.
So someone who was watching quite closely what was going on in the 1980s, how would you compare that to what we see now with the present austerity measures, the cuts and the threatened 500,000 public sector job losses?
Well, when you look at the way the cuts have been targeted against those councils with the highest levels of social deprivation, I think it is just a continuation from where Thatcher left off.
Well, in what way? Continuing? And where's it going to end?
Hopefully with another Labour administration. But there you go.
Yeah, but in what way is that a continuation? Because what Margaret Thatcher was doing was more to do with sort of restructuring industry, maybe. And now it's the more that she seems to be more looking at changing the way the public sector operates, public employees, the people we pay for through our taxes.
It's trying to enhance the role of the private sector within society and in putting that as a central sort of plank of what drives this country. And it's not. It's people that are important in this country and not international capital.
Now, you say you're working for the Communication Workers Union. Who exactly are they? Or who are you, shall I say?
I'm the area processing rep at the Royal Mail site, which is called Bristol Mail Centre, and I am we are one half of the Communication Workers Union. The majority of our membership are either in Royal Mail Group or within British Telecoms. And my role is to oversee the sort of day-to-day running of activities on that Royal Mail site.
So roughly how many members have you got in the South West and in Bristol?
In Bristol we have 4,500 members. In the South West we have upward of 30,000 members.
Now, the only trouble is, Mike, of course, that many people will say, I'm sorry, mate, but the trade union movement's dead now. It's really not much use anymore. And particularly young people coming out of college, they don't see a role for trade unions. They don't join a union when they start work.
But they'll all complain about their terms and conditions of employment, and they'll all complain about being on a minimum wage, and they'll all complain about the lack of respect that they get within the workplace. So there is a defined role for the trade union movement, and it's more important now than it has been in a long time.
Now, amongst the big issues in the city, one of the things that's coming up very soon is the decision about the new Sainsbury's in Southville. Have you been following that? And if so, what do you think? Is this something that the city needs, another supermarket in Southville?
I think this, again, is commercial interest taking precedence over the requirements of the local community.
Okay. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as usual, is with us too. Now, Martin, inflation is up this week. Should we be concerned, and why has it gone up?
Well, it's gone up because partly because commodity prices are being forced up by a speculative bubble in things like oil. We should be worried because what it means is there's more likely to be a rise in interest rates to bring inflation under control, which will then potentially bear down on output. In other words, it's another sign that the economy is not healthy and there's a possibility of a crash recession.
Okay, so is that likely or not?
I think it's pretty likely. I mean, you can't make mistakes as a whole generation of mistakes, as Mike was pointing out. You can't have a whole generation of economic mistakes and expect to get off scot-free. The Labour government's intervention in the market in 2008, in a way, was a stopgap measure, because the economy was broken and nothing much has been done to fix it in the interim. We're now in another bubble phase in the stock market, but the economy's still cooling, and as these cuts kick in, I expect there is going to be a potential crash in this country, and then we'll see what the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats are going to say about that.
Now, Mervyn King was speaking at the beginning of this week. I think it's the quarterly inflation figures he was announcing. He didn't say anything about a crash.
Well, they don't. I mean, don't forget that Mervyn King's job is not to go out there and panic everybody, is it? He's the governor of the Bank of England. His job's to go out there and say it's all right. You've got to read between the lines with these guys.
He's kind of King Mervyn, isn't he? Because the banks really do seem to be in the driving seat at the moment.
Well, they do, and this is a real problem for democracy in a general way. People are going to draw the logical conclusion that no matter who they vote for, the bankers always win, and at that point people are going to realise that what goes on at Westminster is a bit of a diversion, because real decisions are taken elsewhere, and that's the real problem with the way our economy works. It's got to change. We used to know how to manage this. We managed from 1945 to 1973 with a broad consensus about how to manage the economy, which even the Conservatives bought into. All that stuff from 1979 onwards threw that in the waste paper basket. We're now going to have to fish it out of the waste paper basket, get all the old dog ends off it, and have a look at how we used to do things, because we actually used to know how to do things properly.
So in a way, the anarchists we had in the end of last year are right, aren't they? There's no point in voting if the bankers are always going to get in.
Well, in a sense, you can see why that kind of thinking might start to develop, especially amongst younger people. But the fact of the matter is, you can ignore the state, but the state won't ignore you. It does matter to ordinary people what kind of state you live under. Ask the people in Egypt, they know.
Mike, what are your thoughts, finally, now part of our introduction here, on that question about whether there really is any point in voting?
There's always a point in voting. There are many great strides in the past century that have been advanced purely through people voting. I don't think we can trivialise the role that government plays within society, and we could see a world that is nasty, brutish in short, if we didn't have that stopgap on free market capitalism.
But what would you say to people who say, well, it doesn't matter which party we vote for, they all pretty much do the same thing at Westminster?
I think that there has been a convergence in recent years, but I think that there's fresh blood within the Labour Party now, and there's a proper debate going on about the tangent that this country's travelling in, and a recognition that there is failings on that behalf. So yes, there is a need to vote, because if people don't take part in the democratic process, they have very little to complain about when they turn around and say they're not happy about something like ex post facto.
Now, our first political story today is Bristol councillor, who's at the heart of the coconut race rows, decided to quit after this coming local election. And this is referring to Shirley Brown, the Bristol city councillor at the heart of the coconut, in inverted commas, race row, has decided to step down from local politics. Shirley Brown will not fight the Ashley Ward seat when she comes up for re-election in May after 8 years as a councillor. Instead, she'll continue to serve the community in her role as a church minister. Now, Shirley's most high-profile controversy came a year in 2007, in fact, after a seemingly throwaway comment at the council's budget-setting meeting in February 2009. She described Asian Conservative councillor Jay Jethwa as a coconut, a racial slur used to describe someone who is black on the outside but white on the inside. The Lib Dem councillor was alleging Miss Jethwa was selling out her culture by supporting a Tory motion to scrap funding for the Bristol Legacy Commission, which is an organisation supporting ethnic minorities. Now, Jay being an ethnic minority herself. Now, Mike, what are your thoughts about Shirley now stepping down after she feels that it's very difficult for her to continue? As I understand it, her court case has dragged on such a long time, she won't know the outcome of that before the elections, and so she's decided it's really difficult for her to stand. Well, this court case still hanging over her head. This is something that's been going on since last summer.
I think some people have been looking to get political mileage out of this. We're all guilty of saying the odd thing that may be out of turn in the heat of debate, and I really do think that the press have turned on that in quite an aggressive manner. It was unnecessary considering the circumstances.
Well, we did have Shirley Brown on here last year talking about this, and that's exactly what she said. And we then invited Mike Norton from the Evening Post to come and explain why he'd written certain things which Shirley felt were inaccurate in the paper, but he refused to do that. Anyway, Martin, would you like to say what you think about this development with Shirley?
Well, I think it's a shame that this is the only black face on the council, and now she's standing down. And, you know, and it's about a race issue. It's, you know, it's potentially really nasty, and it's a shame. It's a big shame. I mean, people ought to have thicker skins, frankly. We've got to have a serious debate about all of these things. And what she said was probably a little bit tasteless, but a court case, I think that's a bit excessive, frankly.
The other thing is, why has this court case dragged on such a long time?
Because she's appealed the original result.
But surely she could have a result of an appeal within a couple of months. Why does it have to take... I mean, we were talking about this, I think it was last September, and at the time she came in here, she was expecting to have the result, and that's been put off and put off and put off, and still she hasn't had an answer from the courts.
Well, what's actually happened is she's now going to resign from being involved in Bristol politics, and that's not really good for the city, in my view. I mean, people shouldn't be hounded out of office over trivial matters. You know, there's more serious things to talk about, isn't there?
Well, we have... It does actually say in the Evening Post article that the person who reported her to the police was Conservative councillor Chris Windows, and that Mrs Brown was unavailable for comment. But I'll tell you what we will do. We will certainly see if we can get Shirley on this programme in the next few weeks to see how she is, and also to make sure that she gets her side of the story out. Now, it's budget setting time Tuesday next week at Bristol City Council, and the Conservative and Labour groups, the city being run by the Liberal Democrat group, have been putting their budget proposals forward too. Scrapping the place marking director, place making rather, not marking director, and increasing the cost of park and rider among the ideas being put forward by opposition parties for Bristol City Council's next budget. The Lib Dem authority is due to agree its spending plan for 2011 and 2012 at a meeting next Tuesday. It includes £28 million worth of cuts in the city. As part of the budget process, says the Evening Post, opposition parties can put forward proposed changes, and they can suggest areas where more money should be spent and cuts where more money is, well, where money is being wasted. Now, some of the proposals, the Tories have put forward 8 proposals worth £326,000. 3 ideas are shared by both Labour and Conservative Party, including scrapping the £72,000 a year for 2 years place-making director post. Now, you seem to be aligned, Mike, with the Conservatives on this. What's wrong with having somebody who's there to place-make Bristol, to put Bristol on the map?
At the end of the day, we've got to set priorities, haven't we? And we've unfortunately been put in a position where we have to make major savings this year, and we are seeking to protect the most vulnerable within our community, and I think that's a justifiable, reasonable thing to do.
So, what's wrong with this placemaking director? Surely that's something actually quite important, to have someone who's there sort of selling Bristol to Bristol itself and to the outside world.
With the greatest respect, Bristol City Council sell Bristol very well anyway. I don't think that we are short on people selling the benefits of our local vibrant society, and I really do feel that it's just another label, and it's a waste of money, to be honest.
Martin?
Well, yes, I mean, what I would like to say is that we shouldn't be cutting anything in Bristol or elsewhere. As I've said, obviously, if you are running Bristol City Council, central government will create the parameters under which you will operate. So if the Labour Party were running the council, they would have to make cuts because of the central government's diktat. But the policy of cuts is in itself wrong. As we go into the biggest recession, depression in our lifetimes, the government needs to be increasing expenditure on social support, not decreasing it. And that will become obvious as the year progresses and as the economic policy of the government comes to pieces.
Now, just two stories we've seen in the Evening Post this week about, a bit serious, this is just in Thursday's paper, about cuts to the city. Services for vulnerable families face closure as funds are cut. This is a service that supports vulnerable families in Bristol, set to be wound up because the council will no longer fund it. This is more than 40 members of staff, including an outreach worker, 34 outreach workers, are affected by the closure of the Community Family Worker Service. And that's one thing that's been cut. Also, an age charity is also being forced to exit services. That's charity Age UK Bristol is being forced to close two of its services for older people. Where is this all leading, Mike?
Well, I think it's leading to a more unequal society where people are expected to stand on their own 2 feet, and I think it's quite shameful the direction that these cuts are driving us.
Well, I mean, particularly elderly people, sometimes they simply cannot stand on their own 2 feet.
Well, no, absolutely, and this is why one of our proposals is to protect and enhance the Meals on Wheels service and to maintain the lowest possible cost for that service.
And what do you say to those who would say, well, it's Labour profligacy that's led to this situation in the first place?
The Labour government reacted to an economic situation. That economic situation was global, and we did our best to keep the economy afloat during that period of time. The pooling of funding at this point in time is going to cause untold damage.
And is there anything that that you as a councillor can actually do about this?
As you said, we have put forward proposals, but this is merely tinkering around the edges. The fundamental £26 million of cuts that are envisaged for Bristol City Council this year, if you had a Labour administration in Westminster, would not be happening.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts about these particular cuts to local provision for the elderly? I mean, it just seems like this is one of the first things to go for the city.
Well, yes. I mean, I obviously I'm not involved with the city council's budget setting process like Mike, so I tend to take a bigger perspective, and I think that the policy of cuts is wrong-headed. As people are going to realise, I've got a banner for tomorrow's demonstration which I'll be carrying, which says cuts cause crashes, and that's the main message I'd like our listeners to take on board. Government cuts at this stage of the economic cycle are likely to crash the economy, and then the deficit's going to get bigger, as it has in Ireland. And another thing I'd like to flag up, of course, is an Irish general election at the end of this month, and it's very likely Fianna Gael will be the biggest party. They've already flagged up that they're not prepared to pay the debts that their banks have run up. That means that bill will be passed straight back to George Osborne, because the banks who are exposed to that are the British banks. We've already put aside £7.5 billion to help out the Irish, supposedly. It's actually to bail out the British banks. So there's been a £7.5 billion bailout of the British banks in anticipation of what the Irish electorate are going to decide. The Irish can't pay whatever they do, so at some point they are going to refuse to pay. At that point, the British banks will take a hit, and at that point, George Osborne will have to decide whether he's going to be like Gordon Brown, and prop the banks up, or whether he's not going to do that. And none of this has been factored into any of the calculations by the government. It's quite obvious they just presume that there is a recovery. There isn't one.
So you're saying that at some point we're just simply going to have to just chop up the national credit card and throw it in the bin?
Well, basically, most of these debts are unpayable and they've got to be written off. It's got to be an orderly process, and the wealthy people who are owed the money are going to have to lose the money. But they've been fighting very hard to resist that conclusion, haven't they?
Okay, well, on to our next story. David Cameron gives Bristol MP Charlotte Leslie the job of selling his big society, and just gave Charlotte's office a call to see if we can get her on this show in the next few weeks to see how she's going to be getting on with that. David Cameron's handpicked Bristol MP Charlotte Leslie as the woman he wants to be in charge of promoting his ailing big society project in the country. Bristol North West Conservative was unveiled as the ambassador of the Prime Minister's personal mission to bring about social recovery as he attempted to relaunch the concept that so far failed to impress many voters. Now, Mike, how is Charlotte going to be able to manage this in the light of stories like the things we've been hearing just about just now, you know, with elderly services being cut? What is the big society?
That's a very good question, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me that the big society is a ruse to get the country to step into the holes that are created by these cuts, which I think is absolutely appalling. At a time when bankers are being paid enormous bonuses again, that we find ourselves in a situation where we're paying a penalty for that, and we're expected to go out and do the work for nothing to cover the cost of the cuts that have been imposed as a result of that financial crisis.
But surely, the big society is much more about people actually joining up with each other and forming community groups and actually taking action in their local areas.
I think it is, and that has always been supported by the local authorities, and we find ourselves in a situation this year where every charity that relies on the council for some kind of funding is going to be hit with a reduction in that budget. So at the end of the day, if you're serious about the big society, you fund it properly. You don't just have a token £100 million to be spread across the country, but you allow local authorities to continue funding charitable organisations to the level they currently are.
Now, Martin, we also hear that a big society bank has been set up to provide finance for projects, and a further fund will help charities and social enterprises bid for government contracts. David Cameron's also championed the creation of a national citizen service targeted at offering school leavers voluntary work. Now, what about this idea of a big society bank? Because as I understand it, there's lots and lots of money out there in bank accounts that's been forgotten about over the years, and this is one of the things that Mr. Cameron's been able to do, is to get all this money from, you know, people who've died, for example, and then just forgotten about their bank account. No one knew the money was in there, and it's languishing there, that this is all now going to be spent into the economy.
Yeah, but it's going to lend on commercial terms. So in other words, if you're a charity, you've got to show that you've got a business plan which is going to make a profit. Otherwise, why would this bank lend you any money? And this is the big delusion behind all of this. We are not going to get out of the crisis we're in by everybody taking in everybody else's washing. It's just not feasible. And this big society talk, really, I mean, you feel like saying, well, what about talking about the macroeconomy? Let's talk about interest rates. Let's talk about inflation. Let's talk about rising unemployment. Let's talk about a potential bank crash. Let's talk about Irish default. Let's talk about Spanish default. Let's talk about what's going on in Iceland. No, we're talking about the big society. It's like cotton wool. It's got no traction in terms of the situation we're in. It's a wish list. It's made up of wishes and hopes, and it's not based in the reality of the situation.
It's not just wishes and hopes, is it? It's about people going out, meeting people maybe they've never met before in their local area, and taking action.
Well, can I say that tomorrow morning we're going to be meeting people from the local area to demonstrate against Bristol City Council's cuts, and we're hoping it's going to be a big demonstration. And I saw some radicals taking on Vodafone, and they were chanting, David Cameron, can't you see, we're your big society. We're going to give them a big society. It's going to be on the streets of Bristol tomorrow, and it's going to be on the streets of London on March the 26th.
Okay, we'll be talking about that. In fact, we're having a song about that before the end of the programme. Now, cash for internships. The Conservative backers paying the party £2,000 a time to buy their children work experience at top city banks and hedge funds. This was in the Daily Mail at the beginning of the week. David Cameron was accused of gross insensitivity last night after it was revealed that internships with city hedge funds were sold to wealthy Tory children for thousands of pounds. Now, this is at the Conservatives' Black and White Party. They call it the Black and White Party, whatever that means, I don't know. But millionaire Tory supporters paid around £3,000 each for their children to have the golden chance of spending a week or two with a number of top finance companies. And amongst the various things that were being auctioned off to raise money for Conservative Party funds were Lot 4, which was a 2-week internship at CMC Markets, offering an incredible opportunity for a potential to a young trader to get an inside look at the world of international finance. Lot 9 was a week's work experience at Caxton Associates, a Mayfair hedge fund. Lot 10 was a week at public relations company Bell Pottinger. Lot 20, a week at Arbuthnot Latham, the private bank. Lot 30 was donated by former Tory Treasurer Michael Spencer, was a week's work experience at his brokerage company ICAP, source of his £1 billion fortune. Now, just to emphasise, this was actually a secret event which the Daily Mail managed to smuggle themselves into, and guests at last week's event were astonished to have their invitations checked four times before they could enter, while residents complained how it was surrounded by a police ring of steel. Champagne was banned to avoid embarrassing photos, but it did not stop revellers downing gallons of winter Pimm's. Mike, would you just like to give us your impressions of this Conservative Party fundraising effort? Because it looks like they've managed to raise something like, anything up to about £200,000 like this, or maybe even £500,000.
Well, it's shocking, and again, it's people buying advantage for themselves and not really worrying about the wider impact in society, which is, I think is incredibly shameful, but it's the same old Tories, isn't it?
But why doesn't the Labour Party do events like this to raise some money?
The Labour Party is a fundamentally different creature. I mean, let's be quite honest. I mean, our representative base is fundamentally different to that of the Conservative Party.
But, I mean, surely you've got some, at least some supporters in wealthy business positions. Couldn't you get them in to do this, a similar sort of thing, an auction off and make a few bob for the party?
I'm sure there are ways and means, but I mean, we rely on more traditional forms of funding, and we don't buy advantage for our children by doing so.
I think the fundamental point that people need to get here is that politics is funded. And who funds it? The wealthy classes, in the US and here. In the US, Goldman Sachs was the biggest contributor to Obama's election fund once he'd got the Democratic nomination. And money is a very crucial thing in politics, as Mike will be aware. No political force can function without some resources. In Scandinavian countries, the political process is funded by the government, and every party gets support from the government proportionate to its strength in the electorate. And there is no extra money allowed to be spent. And that levels the playing field enormously. We've got a situation here where the wealthy can buy the process, and it's gone even further in the US, where corporations can now donate money to political parties secretly. They don't even have to show what they've done. The parties don't have to even announce the money that they've been given. This makes a mockery of any kind of democratic system, and it's got to stop.
Okay, now on to the 7-7 inquest, and there were bizarre scenes at the London bombings inquest in London this week, as a witness testified to having warned the police and MI5 2 years before these bombs that the alleged bombers in Leeds should be looked at much more closely by the police. Now, I've trawled the internet, but the only report I can find anywhere in the press about this particular testimony was from Andy Davis at Channel 4 News. The rest of the media had decided for us that MI5 were right, and the witness, Martin Gilbertson, was an insane fantasist. Here is the clip from Andy Davis on Channel 4 News.
I've been covering these inquests on and off for the last 4 months, and I don't recall at any time anyone being accused directly of lying, but it happened today, and it was a deeply uncomfortable experience for the man on the receiving end of it. His name is Martin Gilbertson, and he knew two of the bombers, Mohammed Sadiq Khan and Shahzad Tanweer, because he worked alongside them at the ICRA bookshop in Leeds, in Beeston in Leeds, in the early 2000s. Why is he significant? Well, a few years ago, you might recall, he made a series of high-profile claims in media interviews that he was so concerned about the activities of a group linked to this bookshop and the jihadist material they were producing that he went to the police to alert them. This is 2 years before the bombings. Not only that he packaged up two DVDs and a list of names and sent them to West Yorkshire Police with his concerns. West Yorkshire Police today, through their barrister, said to him there was not a single bit of evidence to support this allegation, and they called him, and I quote, an egocentric, self-publicist, fantasist, exaggerator, speculator, and an irresponsible individual. Well, I caught up with him just after this, and this is what he had to say.
I did not lie to the court.
Have you ever lied in the past about your version of events regarding the bombers, the 7th of July bombers?
No.
And your dealings with them?
No, I haven't lied.
The police don't believe you?
I know the police don't believe me, but I don't believe half of what the police say anyway. Well,
Why is there not a single jot of evidence, according to West Yorkshire Police,
that package ever was received by the police? I never said it was received. I said I sent it to them, whether they received it or not. They're saying they didn't receive it. And all of a sudden, I'm a criminal. I don't regret going to the police about 7-7. I will not regret the interviews I gave to the police.
I think the question is, Mr. Gilbertson, did you actually ever go to the police? Or did you make this up?
I did not make that up. I did send that to the police.
Did you make anything else up?
No, I haven't made anything up. My mind... the dates may be slightly out, but I haven't made anything up. Because everything I've said, I've shown evidence that it had happened.
Well, intriguing. Martin Gilbertson absolutely stands by his account. But I think what we're slowly getting into here is this ultra-sensitive issue of could MI5 and the police have stopped the bombers before the 7th of July 2005. Next week we get MI5, an MI5 witness in court, and what we got today was a clear taste of just how robust the security establishment are likely to be on this issue.
Andy Davis at the High Court to the sound of bell ringing practice at St Clement Danes.
Well, this is Martin Summers speaking here. It's interesting that the story we were immediately told about what happened on the 7th of July 2005 keeps changing. Another interesting snippet this week. In the US, a supposed jihadist was released after 4 years in prison. I believe his name was Barbar. And he was released by the American authorities. He was an American-based jihadi, born in New York, but of Muslim extraction. He's released because he'd been working for the US authorities for many years, including when he was running a training camp in Pakistan, which he claims two of the bombers attended.
Now, you mean two of the London bombers?
Two of the London bombers.
Yeah.
What this reminds me of is the Brian Nelson affair in Northern Ireland, where Brian Nelson, the chief intelligence officer of the UDA, in other words, the man who decided who was going to be killed, he made the death lists. He'd been cooperating with the British Army.
That's a loyalist group.
That's a loyalist group. He'd been cooperating with the British Army's Force Research Unit for many years, and when he came to trial, Colonel Jay, who turned out to be Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's now in Iraq, testified that he'd been working for the British for many years and therefore should get a light sentence. But Sir John Stevens from the Metropolitan Police concluded that Brigadier Gordon Kerr was in fact collaborating with Brian Nelson on an assassination programme. And of course, this raises questions about what the linkages are between the British security and American security forces and these jihadi groups, because we've got documented evidence that they were working with these jihadi groups in the 90s when I was an aid worker in Bosnia, and certainly going back to the 80s when they were running them inside Afghanistan. And many people are beginning to question what this so-called jihadi terrorist threat actually consists of, because we've got documented evidence now that they've got massive links with our own security forces.
Now, it'll be interesting to see what happens next week when MI5 take the witness stand, because there was actually a big dispute at the beginning of the inquest, the 7-7 inquest, where MI5 said they wanted to give their evidence anonymously.
Well, don't forget, we were told in the immediate aftermath of the bombings that these guys were complete clean skins. They got no record from the security forces at all. They'd acted alone. They didn't have a mastermind. And now it's gradually dribbling out that it's a lot more complicated than that. And I think that we're being misled, frankly.
So, Mike, have you been following anything to do with these inquests into the London bombings? So first of all, I mean, a normal procedure would be you have a public inquiry, which is one big organisation, rather than these lots of separate inquests. It seems a little bit peculiar to me that you're having an inquest, which is normally into one individual death, for such a big incident as the London bombings.
I have been following it, but I wouldn't like to consider myself an expert on it, although I am quite concerned that the truth is one of the first victims of this process.
Okay, now, the source of the lies about Saddam having weapons of mass destruction was also revealed this week to have been the actual source to have been working for the German Secret Service. His code name, apparently, was Curveball, the Guardian have revealed. And here are his lies being used by Colin Powell back in 2003 to justify the illegal invasion of Iraq at a speech by Colin Powell at the United Nations.
The source was an eyewitness, an Iraqi chemical engineer who supervised one of these facilities. He actually was present during biological agent production runs. He was also at the site when an accident occurred in 1998.
Well, it turns out, Martin Summers, that this was all made up by an agent who was working with the German Secret Service.
Yes, and Joschka Fischer, who was the German foreign minister at the time, has been just written a book saying, well, we told the Americans when we passed this information to them that we thought this guy was possibly dodgy, but we passed it to them because basically we were cooperating with them. But he said we certainly didn't say that they should take this as a gospel truth. Colin Powell is now saying, oh my goodness, I've been misled. I think most sensible people watching this know very well that the decision to invade Iraq was taken probably before 2001, and that in actual fact most of the stuff was made up. I mean, many people realised it was being made up at the time. It's only with hindsight that the kind of more conformist majority are confronted with the fact that it was all made up, but many people realised that at the time.
And Mike, you know, you're a Labour councillor here in Bristol, but your party is totally complicit here, isn't it? Because you were the party that went along with these lies and complied with what effectively now certainly looks like an illegal invasion of Iraq.
Well, the government did. You can't necessarily say that the
Labour
Party
did. Yeah.
Well, no, I think that there was strong resistance to the whole process, and the Labour Party was actively campaigning during the crisis to try and get some other resolution to it. So siren voices within the Labour Party who certainly were flagging that up very early on.
Well, the Labour Party can't be very democratic then, can it? If the leadership, the government, aren't listening to the membership.
Democracy is a very big question, isn't it? And could do with it a whole hour by itself.
Can I just say that in the run-up to the vote on the Iraq war, Blair took all the parliamentary Labour Party aside and said to them that if they didn't vote for the war, I mean, he knew he was going to get a majority because he was going to get Tory votes, but he said, if I don't get a majority of Labour Party support in this division, I will resign. So he put enormous pressure on people like Clare Short to back him, otherwise he would resign. And in actual fact, if Clare Short and a couple of others had actually stuck to their guns, the Labour Party in Parliament would have voted in a majority against the war. And then Blair would have had to go to war with the support of the Americans, the Tories and his own right wing. But the left wing of the Labour Party in the majority would have voted against him. Well, and that was very close.
It's easy to point the finger at Clare Short, but she actually resigned, didn't she, after the invasion?
Afterwards. She should have resigned before, along with Robin
Cook. About the other people that didn't resign after the invasion?
Well, I mean, one of the things that lost David Miliband the leadership of the Labour Party was his pusillanimous stance on Iraq. His brother made that absolutely clear. Ed Miliband made it absolutely clear. If you're not prepared to apologise to the Labour Party and to the British people for the mistake of Iraq, I am going to stand against you for leadership of the Labour Party. He stood against him and he won. And I was really pleased to see his speech at the Labour Party conference, where the first thing he said was everything that happened about Iraq, that was all wrong. And of course, many people in the room were very unhappy to hear that, but I was glad to see them discomforted.
Now, on to another political story, and just looking southward a bit to North Somerset, the North Somerset Conservative Association are having a big row over a bus, we're told by the BBC. The Conservative Party's central office has taken control of the North Somerset Conservative Association after a row that's divided local members. It concerns the money spent on an election battle bus used in the Defence Secretary Liam Fox's election campaign. His election agent, Councillor Carl Francis Pester, has been suspended as the association's president. Councillor denies a charge of showing a reckless and cavalier attitude to the party's finances. Councillor Francis Pester admits spending £5,000 on a 15-seater minibus for Mr. Fox's election campaign. He sold it months later for £1,500, but the cheque he claims to have sent was never seen by the association. Any idea what's going on here? This is North Somerset, I know, Mike, but you're a Labour councillor here in Bristol. Sounds like there's daggers drawn over £5,000, which appears to have gone missing from Liam Fox's campaign coffers.
No, it is quite concerning, isn't it, considering how tight finances are for any political organisation. I can understand why there are reservations in things going on as a result of that money going missing.
Now, I wonder, is there more to it than this? Because, this sounds like just a little bit of a squabble over a minibus. It's a bit trivial. This is the Defence Secretary's Conservative Association here.
Yes, indeed. It makes you wonder why. I would not like to speculate.
Martin, what do you think about
it? Well, it just brings me back to the point we were making earlier about the funding of politics. It needs to be transparent at the very least, and in actual fact we need to level the playing field. And then we need to know all the money that's spent by people on political activities, and we need to know where it's coming from.
The association's chairman, Christopher Alcock, has also been accused of having a reckless and cavalier attitude to the party's finances by the interim association chairman, David Dodd, and he then denies this. Anyway, so I'm sure that that story at North Somerset Conservative Association, we will be hearing more on that one. Anyway, back to work plan to help fewer people than Labour. This is Laura Koonsberg at the BBC. Ministers say the back to work programme, which was announced this week, will be the biggest in history. The government's new work programme will actually help fewer people, though, than the existing schemes that ministers are scrapping. The BBC has found out David Cameron's described his plan as the biggest and boldest push to get people on benefits back to work. But officials have said they expect 605,000 people to go through the scheme in 2011 and a little less in 2012. Now, about 850,000 people went through the last government schemes in 2009-10 called the New Deal. What do you make of Mr Cameron's new plans to get everyone back to work, Mike?
It's just trying to do it on the cheap, isn't it? And I mean, at the end of the day, it's all fair and good giving people the skills to go to work, but they got to have work to go to, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the level of employment in the economy is determined by your macroeconomic policy. And if your macroeconomic policy is to put 500,000 public sector workers on the dole, followed by 600,000 private sector workers, that is the policy. And huffing and puffing about putting people back to work is neither here nor there. Basically, in a situation where you're crashing the economy and putting over 1 million people out of work by your own figures, this is actually a waste of money. Yeah, there's no point spending money on retraining people for 1 million less jobs, is there? It's window dressing as on the rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Well, we shall see how it all goes. Now, what are your thoughts about the welfare shake-up, folks? Because we've also had that this week as well, which is something new called the Universal Credit, which sounds like something from Star Trek or some kind of weird science fiction programme. A universal credit for everybody on benefits and everyone will be treated roughly the same. Now, we've certainly had a lot of complaints from minority groups, like people with disabilities. What do you think about this welfare shake-up, Mike?
Well, I think we've moved away from this idea of there being deserving individuals in society who have fallen on hard times, and we seem to be living in a place now where everybody's looking to blame somebody else for the way they're taking advantage of a situation, which I think is absolutely appalling. There are hundreds of thousands of people in this country who are going to be materially disadvantaged by these changes, and they really haven't got a voice to stand up and fight against it. The changes that are envisaged for the disability living allowance, for example, are absolutely shameful. And some of the people who are being told that they can go to work, considering the current economic climate, is absolute nonsense. And it really is imposing misery on those people in our society who are least able to deal with that.
Well, I mean, first of all, the benefit system as it is an absolute labyrinth that hardly anybody understands it unless you're really good on one specific benefit. And the other thing, of course, is we're running out of money. We need to simplify things and cut down on administration.
There's only parts of this country are running out of money. There are some seriously big pay packets in this country, and I refuse to accept, considering the wealth that does exist in this country, that we're in a situation where we can't support the most vulnerable in society.
Well, I completely endorse that. I think one of the things that Ian Duncan Smith said when he was presenting this, that we used to have a benefit system which used to work because people used to feel shame when they claimed their benefits. And now it doesn't work because nobody feels shame about claiming their benefits. It's like benefits are in place as a human right. People shouldn't be ashamed of claiming what they're entitled to.
It used to be called Social Security, didn't it? Yes. Now it's called welfare. It's sort of a US term.
In France, they would use an even stronger word. They called it social solidarity. Yeah, and I think we've got to, if we're going to have a situation where 1 million more people are put out of work, this idea of putting people who are already on disability, many people are on disability benefit because they lost their jobs in the 1980s, they then lost their health and ended up on disability benefit, and the Conservative government of the time encouraged people to go on disability benefit because it forced down the measured unemployment figures. Now, if they're really serious about this, all that will happen, I've got friends on disability benefit who've been saying to me that they're worried about this, I say all that will happen if they decide you're fit for work is you go on unemployment benefit. So the government doesn't save any money, you just go from disability benefit to unemployment benefit. Since at the same time, many people on unemployment benefit will be going on to disability benefit. It's a merry-go-round. It's a smoke and mirrors game. If you're going to put 1 million people on the dole, as I just said earlier, 500,000 public sector and 600,000 private sector workers, what are they talking about? What?
Labour councillor Mike Woolacott. We're also being told documents are revealing that the cost of introducing this new shake-up has increased from $2 billion to $4.6 billion, just the cost of the introduction.
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, when you look at the, again, private sector providers who are being brought in to cover this, they're going to be looking to increase their costs because they recognise that what is on offer is something that wasn't necessarily in the original proposals from the government. The people that they're looking to get ready for work are people who would find it difficult in economically prosperous times to find work, let alone at the current climate.
And we're also being told that the poorest 10% of benefit claimants will lose more than the richest 10%. The National Housing Federation have also stepped in here because there are some changes being made to Housing Benefit too, which is a group of bodies that manage the social housing in the country, that is housing associations and council houses. The National Housing Federation Chief David Orr has said the cuts to housing benefit for households deemed by the government to be under-occupying, so that's if people are supposed to be under-occupying, this is a new kind of thing that they're bringing in, are extremely harsh and could effectively compel thousands of people to leave their homes. Ministers have long promised to protect the vulnerable, and yet these plans could force thousands to move out of their homes they have lived in for many years. Disabled groups also hit out at moves to replace the disability living allowance with a personal independence payment. A PIP, Leonard Cheshire Disability, have said, "We need assurances that this will not push even more disabled people below the poverty line."
Well, realistically, I mean, this is where we're headed. This is the whole drive of current government policy. It is to create an environment where if you are unable to work, unless you are economically active, you are going to suffer. And that's the reality of the situation. The same is applied with the way that the councils are being treated, with those with a greater level of social deprivation receiving the biggest cuts. Those people who are disadvantaged in society are going to suffer more as a result of this government. And that drive towards encouraging income inequality and quality of life for people in this country is absolutely shameful.
Now I'm joined by Marina Morris. Marina, what have you got for us this week?
Hello. A recent study published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health has found a possible link between diet high in fats, sugar, and processed foods and slightly lower IQ in young children. The study by the Bristol-based Evan Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children, ALSPAC, which is monitoring the long-term health and well-being of around 14,000 children whose mothers were pregnant in 1991 or 1990. Parents were asked to detail the types and frequency of the food and drink their children consume when they were 3, 4, 7, and 8 and a half years old. A diet of mostly processed food at the age of 3 is directly associated with a lower IQ, 1.67 points lower on the IQ scale at the age of 8 and a half, compared to the children who eat a diet rich in fresh fruits and vegetables. This suggests that the effect of early life eating habits may persist in the later childhood, despite any later changes to dietary intake. The study emphasized that they are uncertain that processed foods are the cause of the low IQ, as other factors such as social class and educational background may be implicated. The ALSPAC study has recorded data used by many researchers. Other findings from these studies have included that children from homes with a low council tax value are more likely to be taken to a doctor for everyday symptoms and place a higher burden on GPs. That a mother with a higher dietary intake in pregnancy may lead to increased fetal growth and program the child's brain, possibly resulting in the greater appetite, energy intake, and obesity in later life. Other researchers suggest that food stimulates the brains of chronic overeating in the same way that drugs stimulate the brains of addicts. Studies using brain scan have shown that obese people respond both to food and feeling full differently to thin people. Half the UK's adult population are currently overweight, and about half of those are clinically obese. Obesity is currently reckoned to be costing the UK economy about £10 billion per year in excess health costs and lost productivity. Obesity is one of the new diseases of the 21st century in the developed world, caused by changes in how we live. Unhealthy food, eating more, exercise less, trying to decrease constant stress and feeling of anxiety by eating. And what is our achievement? Suffering. Apart from the health consequences, obesity reduced emotional and social well-being. Overweight and obese adults and children suffer terribly. Food is the most primitive form of comfort. Humans have won many battles against common diseases and infections in recent centuries. We will win the battles against obesity when we change our poor life eating habits and reprogram our mind to healthy lifestyle. Our health is in our brains and our hands.
Thanks, Marina. Now, Mike Woollacott, Labour councillor, Bristol City Council. Now, look, what about this whole business of the way we eat? How do you think we can actually become healthier as individuals through what we eat and the way we eat? And does that government actually have a role in this, or is this simply something for people to sort out for themselves?
At the end of the day, it's quite simple. To eat a healthy diet, you have to have the money to afford it. If you look at the cost of anything organic or anything that has a positive impact on your health, you're paying good big money for it. The fact that cheap processed food is the cheapest on the shelf by quite some considerable distance is the main reason that a lot of people on low incomes are forced down that road of choosing to feed their families on that product.
So what Marina was saying there is essentially that we've got about a quarter of our population is clinically obese. Surely these austerity measures are going to put paid to that, aren't they?
Are they going to make people eat more healthily? I think it would get people to turn to comfort eating, to be quite honest. But encouraging people to have a more healthy lifestyle is something that's broader and wider than the government's willing to take on at the moment. It does require government interference to encourage people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very influential study that's come out last couple of years, called The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett. I can remember the names, I think Wilkinson and Pickett. But it shows that the more equal societies are, the less health problems they have. And one of the reasons people comfort eat is not just because they're out of work or they haven't got money, it's also to do with a whole society in which you are at the bottom, in which maybe having your burger is actually one of the few things that makes you feel happy.
Yes, yeah, so what Marina's saying there is that the food is the most primitive form of comfort, and it may be a symptom.
Absolutely.
The overeating may be a symptom of what you call tension.
Traditionally, you would find, say, in the 18th century, that the wealthier people were fatter and the poorer people were smaller. It's now been reversed, but of course being overweight is unhealthy as being too thin. But it's all based, lots of these things depend very much upon the kind of society you live in and whether you feel valued and respected as a person, and whether your community is a good community. And those things, of course, have a great bearing on all of the other topics we've been covering in this show.
Now, there's a march tomorrow going on in Bristol City Centre, and which is, I don't know if, Mike, if you could just come back over here and just tell us when the march is taking place, or maybe you can do it, Martin.
Okay, I'll do it.
And this is to do with the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance, which Mike is a part of. Martin, would you like to just tell us
yes,
where
well,
when
it's,
the march
it's
is
tomorrow. Saturday 19th of February, it's to protest against the British Bristol City Council's £30 million worth of cuts. It says on the leaflet here. It assembles at 11 a.m. at Castle Park, and it will march to College Green. And it's supported by the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance and various union branches, and I presume the Labour Party.
And the very absolute first ever on this programme, we've got a bit of live music from local musician Ashigi. So go for it, Ashigi. Let's have a bit of music about the Anti-Cuts Alliance march.
Here we go.
From Castle Park
to College Green. A motley band of rebels cry austerity is obscene. We defy the bankers. We defy the cuts. Come, Bristolians, and stand up for your rights. We come in peace to take this town. The coalition has no mandate. It must be brought down. The bankers' bailouts, we do deny. For as they gambled, they said, let society fry. This corporate tyranny, we do disdain. Where Tesco will buy and sell healthcare for private gain by stealing billions. They axe our schools, slash and burn, while the rich rewrite the rules. They train the cops to trickle us well. TV cons us with X Factor and mindless consumer hell. We shall not worship the god they serve, the mammon of greed, while the services starve. With people together, in the end we'll win. We shall not bow to threats or be fooled by their spin, for we are strong and we are free. So stand up, Bristolian, stand up now. Yeah, yeah, stand up, Bristolian, stand up now. Come on, come on, stand up, Bristolian, stand up now.
Thank you, Ashigi. Now, Mike, if you just want to step back to the microphone again, can you just tell us a little bit about this tomorrow, and what is the Anti-Cuts Alliance?
The Anti-Cuts Alliance is a group of trade unions that are pulled together, trade union activists from across the Bristol area, to organise some kind of fundamental resistance against the current austerity measures that are being put forward by the government.
But shouldn't you really be doing this through political avenues, like through your party up in Westminster and that kind of thing?
At the end of the day, these austerity measures were not necessarily something that anybody voted for in this country in last May's election, and it had been foisted upon people at very short notice. There are millions of people in this country who are going to suffer as a result, direct result of government policy, and we need to try and organise and try to resist this these proposals.
And also there's another march coming up in London soon, isn't there?
There is indeed. There's a TUC organised march on March the 26th up in London. Every major trade union is involved in that. The Labour Party is involved in it, and there will be over a million expected on that day.
Okay, Mike Woolacott, thank you very much, your Labour councillor for Brislington East. After the news, with nowhere near enough paid work to go round, and those jobs there are not paying enough to live on, how long are we going to put up with the war on Britain by the fraudsters still walking the streets of London? We talk to the Green Party Economics Group, Brian
you
Leslie. See you after the news.
FM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol